Ever heard the one about people being more afraid to speak in public than they are of drowning? Well, that actually happens to be true. For decades now, psychologists and survey takers have been asking people what they're most afraid of, and time after time, the answer that beats all others is public speaking. To get to the heart of why, I spoke with Eileen Sinnett for this episode of Convo. Eileen's a speech coach and owner of Speaking That Connects in New Jersey. It turns out the problems people have with public speaking are not just for big public speeches on a stage. Being afraid to speak up can also be a big problem at work, and that's a problem that starts early on.
Why is public speaking such a big fear is the question. And I think there's a lot of reasons, one being that we don't do it all the time, and we don't get trained to do it early enough or get the right training at the right time. And I think there's a misconception that because people can speak, it's the human skill set that differentiates us from other mammals, animals, etc., species, that because we can speak to one person or a group of people, we can stand up in front of a group and speak equally strongly and comfortably. And there's a lot of differences, standing up versus sitting down. I think there's this polarity that happens that separates the speaker from the listener. Logically, the speaker is doing all the talking and the audience is doing all the listening. One person's standing, 50 people are sitting. One has to prepare, the others have to be present, but without much preparation. And compared to conversation, which is spontaneous and what we do most of the time, public speaking requires some preparation. So between the lack of or correct type of education at the right time and the myth that all speaking is the same, I think we have some of the reasons why public speaking is such a fear.
Well, it is a weird dynamic, though, isn't it, that we start early on in life where basically it's you're always listening to somebody who's taller than you. You know, you're listening to your parents, you're listening to the teacher or whatever. And then I guess being put in that kind of space where suddenly everybody's looking at you. I mean, why is that such a problem that people are looking at you? What is the difference between, say, two people looking at you when you're having a conversation at a restaurant and 50 people suddenly looking at you? Is it like the dream where people are wearing their underwear in public or something? Is it just they feel...
I'm not going to go there right now, and that's one of those things I think is crazy, to think of people in the audience as being undressed. That wouldn't make me calmer. It would make me more nervous.
Yeah.
But I think there's an implied authority when you're in front of a group standing, like you said, the teacher, the parent, they're taller. You are now the speaker authority. And it can trigger for some people a sense of, am I worthy enough? Am I smart enough? Do I know enough? I have to influence or keep this audience attending to what I have to say. Am I good enough? So there's some of that for some clients. That whole idea of that authoritative position and the self-doubt that you own that inner authority.
How does this apply to, say, everyday life? I mean, it's one thing to think about being in front of a chamber of commerce or in front of a class or, you know, wherever else, and there's a bunch of people sitting there taking notes about what you're saying, and you're supposed to be the one they're there to see and listen to and all that stuff. But how does this, you know, people have a fear of public speaking. How does, on like, say, a daily basis, I mean, this does...
I can give you a very good example of that. Several clients of mine have been referred because of their inability to contribute to a meeting. So while they're very attentive in terms of listening and very proactive when the meeting is over in terms of execution, in the corporate arena, there's something not okay with being silent in this culture, that you don't know if that person who's silent really understood or is a team player, just because they're not speaking up. And one person in particular said she wants to speak up, but she just can't. It really goes back to deeper, older roots of embarrassment, of shame, of some level of trauma. And so even though there's a wish to contribute, and this is the everyday situation, there's this stuckness in terms of having a conversation.
Well, you know what's interesting is I found out, and I think I was talking to you about this last time we spoke, in which I was talking to somebody else. I was interviewing with someone else where I was the one being interviewed. And I realized that there's a difference between having an interview conversation and having a conversation. And when I'm on the other end of it, I mean, I do this for a living. I talk to people for a living. I ask questions for a living. I direct conversations for a living. And then suddenly somebody comes along and is directing the conversation with me. And I totally, you know, the whole thing. I mean, I just tanked it. You know, it didn't go well for me at all, because there's a, you know, suddenly this weird pressure to, I think, not so much perform maybe, but I think to please the other person. You know what I mean? Like, you kind of want to live up to what they are asking you for. You kind of want to, you know, kind of get a pat on the head, I guess, is a better way to put it. You know, you're a good boy. You answered correctly or something. But it can be very intimidating to do this. I try to keep that in mind when I talk to people. Fortunately, you don't seem to be intimidated by me.
Here, you're saying is that it's like a validation that you might be looking for in terms of pleasing the interviewer. But for me, and I think that can be true for some people, obviously for you. I think it's also being at the effect and not in control of what you're normally good at. So, you know, I'm being interviewed by you. That's not my regular skill set. I don't know what question's going to come at me at what time. So then I have to really own my subject area. I have to be comfortable with who I am in terms of responding without feeling less than or nervous or having to please somebody.
Right. Well, I think you hit that right on the head with having to own your subject. You know, it's kind of like when I've heard actors talk about, you know, people say things like an actor disappeared into a role, and actors will correct you and say, no, it's not, it's the other way around. The actor owned that role so much that it can draw. You know, the character basically is inside the actor, not the actor inside the character. You know what I mean?
And yes, I do.
So I think you hit it right on the head with that, is that you need to own your subject. You need to own your ideas. You need to own your knowledge. And it's a strange irony to me that a speech especially, or a meeting or an interview, is such a controlled environment in the way that there's a formality to it. There's a rhythm and a pace. Like, I talk and then you talk and then I talk and then you talk. We're not just blah, 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 blah over top of each other. And yet at the same time, in that element of controlled environment, there is a lack of control, because you don't really know where inside this controlled environment's going. It's weird.
Exactly. So while there are linguistic rules, communication rules for conversation, for discussion, for presentation, they're not always followed. And if you can just think of a meeting in a business setting where 12 people are there to discuss a project, but the more vociferous contributors will take over and the quiet guys or gals will sit back, or the leader will call the meeting and just make a, you know, executive decision. That's not what it's supposed to be. Or even crossfire. You know, and people talking at the same time, and you see it on political, you know, shows on television all the time. It's not the quiet, respectful, let a person finish. So while there are rules, the rules are always broken, and you really don't know what's going to come at you. So I think that's part of it.
I think there's just, I mean, I agree with you. I think there's a lot of, I think we think there are more rules than there are. I think it's, you know, I don't know what the good analogy is, and I don't want to sort of over-metaphor the whole thing, but it just...
Well, let's say that there are rules, but you can pass a stop sign if you don't get caught. You know, you've done it.
Right.
And I think in business, there are a lot of broken rules in terms of what language, communication, and interaction are supposed to be about.
Do you think a lot of it is that people are, and I know you've kind of answered this, but do you think a lot of it is that people just are afraid to sort of bear themselves? Because I try to keep in mind, I don't sing in front of people, for example. I don't have any problem talking in front of people, but I don't sing in front of people, and I just can't do it. I just, if you ask me to, I just suddenly clam up. I can't do it.
And well, I didn't know that about you, but I don't sing in front of people because I don't like my voice. And it probably didn't start day one as a child, but I do remember being told by the music teacher in eighth grade, Eileen, would you just sing a little more quietly so we can hear the others? Obviously,
wow.
I wasn't a good singer. So you can override that, perhaps, if it's important to you. I mean, I wasn't the best dancer, but I continued to dance.
Right.
But for me, you know, singing is not my skill set, so I choose not to sing. And, you know, speech is supposed to be your birthright as being a human being. You know, we are the speaking species. So it's a shame when people assume that they can't, they're bad at it, they shouldn't, all those negatives. When I think ultimately people are interesting, they have interesting stories, they have credentials, they have credibility, and they could be good speakers.
I agree with you, obviously. I mean, I do this for a living because I like hearing people's stories. But, you know, I think the idea of bearing yourself is, you're right. I think people don't feel comfortable doing it. They think, you know, like, for example, I can't tell you how often I hear somebody say to me, I hope I gave you what you wanted. I hope I'm answering this correctly. Or please don't make me sound stupid or something like that. People are very, very aware. I think there's just this inherent self-consciousness that we have when we speak, when, you know, people are paying attention. And the funny thing is we talk all the time, you know?
Exactly. I think that goes back to that sense of ownership, of self-validation, you knowing that what we know, and feeling that emotional okayness to speak our minds or to share what we know, that it's not there to please someone all the time. It's there to be heard. And I think maybe the vulnerability comes from it, again, not being something that happens routinely. You're not at the end of an interview every single day, but you may go to work every day. You're not taking, you're not giving a speech every day, but maybe three times a year. You're a conference presenter. So our normal communication skills are good enough for most of our activities. Like you said, we speak a lot. But when it comes to being publicized, you know, maybe in an interview, that may be where that self-consciousness shows up. I'm in front of a whole audience. It's at a conference. I'm on the other end of Scott Morgan's show, you know.
Right.
I'm being broadcasted to a whole lot of people. I hope I don't sound stupid. I hope I don't make a mistake. I think a lot of people will go in that direction.
I think a lot of it also probably has to do with when people hear themselves on tape. Well, I mean, if you're old like myself, yes, and you know what tape actually is, but, you know, as opposed to digital. But you know what I mean? You hear yourself on a video or something, and then people say, oh, my God, does my voice really sound like that? And I think a lot of times when we talk, we're not really listening to ourselves. And when we are put on the spot to answer a question, we have to be very conscious of ourselves, you know, in that same sense. So
especially if we're taped, either radio or television or video. And there is a difference for every person in the way they hear themselves versus how everyone else hears themselves, and it has to do with the physiology of hearing.
Right.
Every individual hears themselves through a combination of air and bone skull conduction, but all your listeners only hear you through air conduction.
Right.
And so it does sound different. And I think that is an issue, particularly for audio. I think video, you get more self-concern around, I look fat, I don't like my hair, I look old, I wish I didn't wear that tie, I should have worn a different color, I pace too much, my hands look funny. You get a lot of criticism on what you see.
I think my own personal criticism is I look like my grandfather, and I'm, you know, the thing is my grandfather was like 65 when I was born, because my mom was a lot older, you know, when she had me, and I, you know, I'm not 65 yet, so I don't want to look like that guy. And then the more I look at him, he lived to like 99 years old or 98 years old when he died, and it's like, man, you know, I look like him, and I think, do I look that old? I mean, just, you know, I mean, do I look like an 85-year-old lumpy Italian-looking guy, you know, just, you know, sort of that Abe Vigoda look. And it's like, man,
it sounds like judgment, you know, that's what we're talking about.
Right.
That's inner judgment. So before we were talking about self-doubt and being in front of a group and being the one who's standing and feeling the authority. And now we're really talking about judging ourselves.
Right. But I think
I think they're kind of perhaps, you know, two sides of the same coin.
Right. Well, that's what I'm saying. It's kind of this is all a kind of a tapestry. There's no one answer, I think, is the...
No, I don't think there is one answer. I was talking to someone yesterday who said, look, I don't have any trauma like you're suggesting some people have in terms of being a public speaker, but I just don't like talking to a group. And, you know, I didn't have a childhood molestation. I wasn't bullied in school. I didn't move three or four times in 1 year and not be able to make friends. I don't take beta blockers for anxiety. None of that stuff happened to me, but I don't like public speaking.
Right. Well, sometimes you just don't like it. I mean, you know.
And sometimes it might have to do with, say, your kind of predisposition, your psychological makeup, your neurologic sensitivity. So introvert versus extrovert versus, you know, dynamic in front of groups versus shy in front of groups. So I think it could also be your neurology, physiology. You know, if you think about, what's her name? Susan Cain wrote a book on Cold Quiet.
Oh, that's a great book.
It is a great book.
That's a very good book.
And it points out, you know, the strengths of introverts. And so they may not be as comfortable in front of a group, but they're great thinkers and creators and innovators. And those are just other reasons. You know, someone who's a great writer may enjoy that feeling of taking time and editing to express the idea as perfectly as possible, whereas a great presenter is not usually a word-for-word speaker from a manuscript. It's usually a heart-based, you know, knowledge-based communicator. And live speech versus written, you don't do so much editing without making yourself look like you're erasing what you just said.
Yeah, I'm very familiar with that dynamic, actually.
Yeah, I'm sure you are. Yeah. So so I would say for an introvert to feel like they could, who's a writer, to be a great speaker, that would be a bigger stretch.
Right.
Than for someone who's a salesman who likes to speak, even if they don't do the greatest job, they may not have any of that fear.
Right.
Because speaking is fun.
Well, you know what I always wonder? I'm always trying to sort of find the balance between what is the best thing to do versus how much of it is me changing myself to fit into some prescribed idea of what should be. And despite the fact that I'm on the radio, despite the fact that I communicate for a living, despite the fact that I have no problem, you know, presenting or teaching or whatever, anything like that, I never have, I am not an extroverted person. I'm a very introverted person. If you saw me shopping, you wouldn't even recognize me. My head's down. You know, if I go to the store, it's like, I'm just, how are you doing? You know, kind of thing. I don't, you know, it takes me a while to warm up to people. I'm very much an introvert. So, you know, you bring up the book Quiet, and it's one thing I've always wondered is how do we bring out the sort of introvert from somebody who, you know, needs to communicate, doesn't necessarily like to, without actually turning them into an extrovert? Because let's face it, this world is not easy on introverts. This world is very much made for extroverts and big personalities. They get the attention. They make their points. They're not worried about, you know, being the center of attention. And there are people like myself who don't like to be that and don't want to be that. How do you actually tell somebody, this is how you present? You know, how do you do this without actually changing them from, you know, trying to turn them into an extrovert or something?
So my approach to people is there are skill sets and then there are the personality pieces and the history of people that are also, you know, involved in being front and center as a speaker. The skill sets everybody can learn, they're more outside in instruction, how to stand, how to look. You can bypass your emotional discomfort to some degree by not acting as if, but by learning what looks right. So how to stand, for example, is a real easy task to learn. It may not be your natural everyday way of standing. Maybe you lean on one foot or you have a wide base. But if you know that when you're on a camera and all the audience are like multiple cameras, you're going to appear more positive and be received more positively if you're not leaning, if you're standing, you know, in a certain kind of way. And so I think once you show a person, like, this is what you look like, sound is off. Let's just look at the feet. Sometimes we'll just do a part of the body, not the whole thing, and get agreement that, yep, this is this. I can do this, and yeah, this does look better than this. You know, so the person's still an introvert, but they have now a little bit of direction to do something that's within their ability that doesn't belie who they are. So it's taking an introvert and showing them how to stand in front of a group, right? It's taking an introvert and saying, let me collaborate on your content and work the plan. So you're still an introvert in those stages.
It's interesting about how this relates to just general interpersonal communication, not even, you know, public speaking per se, but just communication, especially through body language, because I don't want to make this all about me. The only reason I'm bringing myself up as an example here is because, well, I'm familiar with me, so I can speak with some authority. But
I appreciate it.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
I have a friend who is one of those people that, you know, if we go someplace, she will always make a friend. Somebody will talk to her. You know, she'll blah blah blah. And then, you know, later on, she'll say, oh, remember that person we met at whatever? And, you know, like, yeah, it's like, oh, yeah, yeah, we were hanging out the other night. And it's like, huh? And it doesn't occur to me to think that way about people. And the exact opposite thing happens to me. If she goes out by herself, we always have a joke where I say, don't get hit on, because, you know, she'll go out and people always want to come talk to her. And the thing is, if I go out by myself, which is not that common, but if I do, people specifically take seats away from me, you know? I mean, if there are, you know, I mean, I've seen people sort of, I've seen them specifically move down, you know, or whatever. And I think, what the hell is it about me that, you know, is so, I mean, do I look like I'm going to murder people or something? And I remember her telling me one time, she said, there is a thing about your body language that is just very much.
Off-putting.
Yeah. It very much is, I'm not going to listen to your BS. Don't try to sell me anything. Don't try to get in my space. Leave me alone. And I'm like, well, what about times where I think, well, I'd be okay if, like, somebody came up and talked to me? She's like, no, it's just your body speaks very loudly.
And not just the body. I think we underestimate the power of energy and what I call the invisibles. So it could be a thought. It could be a vibration. It could be an aura. It could be your body language. But I think people have energetic fields based on how they're feeling or based on what they're thinking or based on who they are. And we're always reacting to that, even though we might be unconsciously reacting to it.
Well, I always did think that people were much more intuitive than they give themselves credit for in that same way. I think I agree in the sense that I think there are people who can read other things about other people. I just think people who are, you know, very good at it are the ones who are paying attention to it more than other people. But I think we all kind of have that. I think we all sort of can tell when somebody's dangerous or somebody's really happy or somebody's, you know, you kind of get that, you know.
Yeah, somebody we want to be around or someone who looks like they want to be left alone. And we don't have to be psychologists. I think there's some, like you said, intuitive ability in, say, people in general, if they're conscious in any way, that says, you know, I don't want to be that close to this person, or, you know, I really want to meet that person. Even if you're more reticent, you could still say, hey, that person over there looks really like fun. I wish I could go over and say hello.
Yeah, it's that old charisma thing, I guess. I remember hearing about Bill Clinton, and people said that's the thing about him. However you feel about him politically, you can't not like him, and you can't not notice him when he comes into a room. And all he's got to do is come in and stand there. And everybody just knows that he's there. There's just some sort of pulse that comes out of a guy like that. And I think a lot of people, like myself especially, just we don't understand how that happens. It's like, what are we doing? That's so different. I mean, what are these sort of subtle cues that we're giving to other people? Like when you say about energy, like what causes that energy? Like what where is it coming from? That
well, I kind of see, I mean, I don't know if you can follow me with this idea, but if you took a, say, if you made a drawing of a person, just an outline, like a gingerbread form.
Okay.
And you put a bunch of circles like cells, you know, throughout from head to toe, fingertips, toes. And you each of those cells or circles represented a piece of that person's life, an experience, something that they were told, something that they learned. And you saw that some of them were really very positive, and some of them were kind of negative, and some of them might be neutral. When you have this schema, and this is just an idea I have, that to answer your question, how do you get that confidence or charisma? If those represent energetic moments or experiences, and some of them are really darkened to say they were negative, and others are, you know, more illuminated to say, the more illumination, the more at ease your life was, the more validation you got, the more positives that came to you, I think come out to create or help to shape that personality as, quote, charismatic or confident. It's just an idea I have, you know. I'm taking a two-dimensional drawing and superimposing my concept on it. Basically saying more positives in one's life, less stress.
That would be
more
nice.
Affirmation, less judgment. It adds up, and you get a composite.
That's an interesting thought. You know, it really is. It's something. I do follow you, by the way. You know,
thank you.
So,
good.
But yeah, no, it's a very interesting thought. That's something to think about. And you know, people talk about how your changed perspectives will, you know, because I mean, something I've noticed. You know, I mean, I've been through my periods of time where I've been down about something or whatever, and it's funny how people just don't seem to want to come near you when you're down. They do feel that sort of dark shadow around you. And I think a lot of times people are sort of afraid there's a contagion of, you know, and I know I don't want to necessarily get into mental illness with this whole thing, but I think, you know, there is that kind of sense that people have. And then when people lighten up, it's amazing how many more people suddenly just show up, you know, and different kinds of people show up when you change your sort of energy and your perspective, and it brings in more people. But it's still fascinating how that plays out.
I think
charisma.
It's fascinating as well. And maybe when you're down, and we're not going to stay on this, you know, psychological piece totally, but when you're down and you feel removed or in despair or whatever it is, I wonder if your inner dialogue is, you know, storylining a lot of negatives or a lot of, you know, sadness or a lot of, you know, deprecation or negatives. And those thoughts are energetic too. Thoughts have an energy to them. Versus if you're joyful and without despair or depression, maybe you're just in the moment, you know, without thought, without focusing on something. And, you know, mind, you're present in the moment versus present to your thought.
Hmm.
You're present to the world.
Interesting.
I know for me, when the sun's shining, I'm a happier person.
Me too, actually.
And I'm more open to other people. And when it's gray, like it was here for 3 days, it's effort to stay in a positive place.
For sure. Well, here in Northeast Texas, last week, it was, I mean, when I say it rained, I'm talking it rained, like it was deluging rain. Floods, you know, floods on the street. I mean, everything, you know, it just really, really long rain all week. You know, it was 7 or 8 straight days of just, you know, rain just coming out, thunderstorms, heavy winds and everything. And, you know, even letting the dog out, she didn't want to go out. You know, she was sort of looking at the back door like, you know, kind of thing.
Not me.
Yeah, she's like, I don't want to go out there. It just, you know, it was kind of cold. It was kind of drippy. And I got to tell you, I mean, even just some days just sort of looking out and thinking, I remember what blue sky looked like was, you know, it was hard. So I'm sort of affected by the same thing. But it's interesting how, you know, we're sort of talking about control and awareness as, you know, something that holds us back. And yet, kind of what you just said is that letting go a little bit, sometimes you catch people just sort of really into something and they're not consciously aware of what they're doing. They're just into it. They start playing an instrument or they start to sing or they start telling a story.
Right. They're one with it.
Yeah.
And they're in that moment. I can't tell you how many people who I've seen say, could I just have a drink before I go out to speak publicly?
Oh, yeah.
Because I'll be loosened up then. And, you know, I'm more myself that way.
I know people like that too.
And it's interesting. I totally understand it. I know what a drink does, you know, in a good way.
Right.
So it's like some of that anxiety about, am I good enough, strong enough, or I can be more comfortable. I can be more comfortably at ease with myself if I'm a little bit altered.
Right. You know, let me ask you somewhat of the devil's advocate question on this same topic. I think in a lot of ways these days, and especially in American culture in the 21st century, we're very, I hate to say this, but I think we're all a little self-impressed and we're sort of taught by way of, you know, technology and social media and everything else that goes along with it, that, you know, we're all sort of this personal brand. But the thing is, what I've noticed is that everybody, it seems to be that people have stopped looking at other people and noticing them, and everybody kind of wants you to notice them in return. And I think people can get a little swallowed by that monster. So I guess my devil's advocate question is, how do we get people to be confident to be themselves without getting mired into this self-inflated sort of 1970s EST self-actualization stuff? How do we get them to be competent and dynamic without turning them into these sort of self-impressed, self-inflated monsters?
Probably early education in terms of other acceptance is something that I would say would help focus. I mean, kids learn it early, but I think the workforce changes that a bit. Maybe as we have, and we have such an international global workforce, the diversity, there's so many differences in so many cultures, and that maybe that'll level set some of that.
Hmm.
But I really don't know that I have the, that's a good question. But I think I bet it's more of a minority than you think. There's always one.
That's true.
Always one who wants to talk all the time, who pushes to the front of the line, who doesn't, you know, have a care in the world to listen to what you have to say, even though you've given them 10 minutes of your time.
Right.
But I think it probably is the minority, and I wouldn't be surprised if that person underneath has insecurities that they just never addressed.
You know, and you're right. You know, I should probably, I don't know whether to apologize for thinking that way, but it's just, you know, I guess it's kind of like, you know, if you've ever worked retail, which I used to when I was working my way through college, it was, you know, a lot of retail, just jobs at bookstores or, you know, department store, whatever it was I was working. And there was always that one or two people a day or every couple of days that was just a jerk. They were just obnoxious about something. And I always had to constantly remind myself, I saw 300, 400, 500 people today, and one of them was that problem. Yeah. So, I mean, most everybody's fine.
And you see it a lot in restaurants.
Right.
The way people treat service people, waiters, waitresses, and sometimes, you know, they're just not people. And it's, why did this come out cold? Or why is this medium and not medium rare?
Right.
But it's the attitude. It's as if that other person is less than in some way.
Combo is a production of KETR-FM in Commerce, Texas. Production and logo design by Scott Morgan. Music by Arik Deninja. Additional episodes of Convo are available at KETR.org. You can support this program and others like it by visiting KETR.org and clicking donate.